Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to North and South Podcasts. And this is a creativity and politics podcast, I think, because it's about football. But I've got a friend of the podcast, Paul Dorgan, and he was my inspiration, who was responsible for the Mersey podcast, which was a great series of podcasts he did, which I listened to, I think, during lockdown, Paul, the first lockdown, which I really enjoyed. He's also a journalist and a musical talent. And Paul, what is the name of your, what's your artistic name and how would you describe yourself?
That's two different questions in one there. Hello, everyone. Hello, Tim, and thanks for inviting me on, by the way. You don't have to say I was your inspiration. That you're just making me...
But you were.
All right, fair enough. That's your... Yeah. That's your choice. Well, no, I appreciate that, Paul. So it's Die Tanzfläche. Tanzfläche means dance floor in German. And it should have a little accent over it as well, the two dots, which I should know what that's called. Is it an umlaut, is that called?
I'm not sure in German. So what we'll do is we'll put your link to on Spotify there so people can check out your music, which is dance-orientated, but you like to dip into different types of dance, don't you?
Yeah, it's electronic music. It's basically anything from, like, the first single I brought out, which was, I got Ableton Live, so professional music software, in December 21. And the first one I like tune I'd done is like 148 beats per minute. So I'm quite Aphex Twin.
Well, we love the Aphex Twin. Yeah. I think we should just have a chat about music as well on another podcast, Paul, just talking about music and go off in any direction we want. But people, check out his stuff. I've listened to it. He's got Spotify. You've got it all on Spotify, haven't you? It was recently played at a Bongo's Bingo, which is becoming bit of a cultural thing around the UK where people go and play bingo but have lots of fun at the same time and drink lots. You've also been on a few radio stations and got some recognition through different types of media, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, at the moment as well, I've got a couple of things that are possible, you know, quite exciting events coming up in the summer as well, which is basically around the corner. So I'm just waiting to see what's going on there. And also, there's something quite exciting that I will release very soon, but I'll know a bit more about that in a week's time. So I don't know the full details there, but I've got a distributor music at the moment, but moving forward, I may have another specific outlet to release. But yeah, anyway, let's stop talking about me.
No, but I've shared that with some friends as well, your music, and we put it on our Spotify playlist to some of your tunes. And it is good. And even if you're not into dance music per se or electronic music, it's worth checking it out. And good luck with all that moving forward, mate, because I know you're very passionate about it. And I love my music as well.
The slower stuff on there as well. It's not all
100. Yeah, it's a good mix.
It's like 112. It's like really slow stuff as well. So it's for, you know, don't be put off. Monica.
Cool. Right. We're going to talk about football today. And I've done a podcast myself on football, but never released it. And I've wanted to speak to a few people about football. Now, we're both Evertonians, and as we know, as of the 6th of May, 23, it's unlikely Everton are going to go down this season on the balance of probabilities. And it's not a good time for Everton, but I want to have a chat about football more generally, because that's what I've been angling to do for the last 18 months, 2 years. I don't want to just talk about any of the negatives to do with modern football. We can talk about the positives of it. We can talk about, you know, how important it is as a galvaniser and identity, etc. Now, my mum and dad met at an Everton game many years ago, and I was kind of raised without being forced to be an Evertonian, but kind of by default, I became an Evertonian. And my first memory of Everton was when we won the Cup Winners' Cup final, and Neville Southall was wearing a red top, which is the colour of our arch rivals, Liverpool, which is interesting. But, I mean, for me, I was talking to a Blue yesterday, and we're going to talk about football generally here, but I was talking to a Blue yesterday about our likely relegation. He said, at the end of the day, it's just football, isn't it? It's just a sport. It's just a game. And I always think when it comes to football, because I've stopped playing it recently, I never thought I'd stop playing football. I play footy with yourself. You're a good player. I don't know if you're still playing. But
no.
I stopped playing football in recent years because I was feeling the damage to me by playing to my knees, my back and stuff. And I've stopped playing. I love the sport. I love the game in terms of the individual, the team, the coach, and all that, the way it all comes together. But for me, it's very much a case of the red pill and the blue pill from the Matrix. I choose to accept football and take it far too seriously as an Evertonian. But I know fundamentally inside it's crap, which is something that, say, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Donald Trump couldn't actually do. So I would say that I'm not as fanatical, as much of a zealot as those kinds of people. And if you show me something like a decision and I can see that we did give the penalty away or we were offside, I can accept that, you know, that I think I would like to think I'm a rational football fan who can acknowledge the reality of the game, that it is just a sport. It doesn't really matter. But the state of modern football really concerns me. And I'm just wondering, what are your views on football then in terms of, you know, it's a beautiful game, etc. People take it too seriously. And what's your spin on football at the moment? And I'm not just talking about the Premier League. I just mean like football generally, globally, after the World Cup. I've asked you a million questions there. So where are you coming at as a journalist and someone who's been a sports journalist in the past?
Well, I tend to separate my work life from personal. And I think that the way I view it, and I've certainly, you know, as you know, obviously I've got an 18-year-old son who comes to the game with me, Tom. Obviously, you know, you've known him for time now.
He's a good player as well.
He was far better than both of us. And he stopped playing as well through injury, and he's only 18. When we go to the game, we're from our vantage point, we have the ability to be able to be reserved mostly in a way where you can sort of detach yourselves. But that's, I have always let Tom to his own thoughts. So he doesn't have to agree with me. Yeah. That's not the way it works for me. It's not, you know, he will, you know, we'll have a chat about things. And I might say that I think he's wrong in certain ways, and he would say the same to me that I'm wrong, you know, if there are certain things. And you know, I would say that most of the time he is right, that I am. But I've in years gone by, and this is just on a personal level, when I'm attending the game as a season ticket holder, seeing the game where you're not sort of controlled or contravened by the television cameras when you're watching it in a pub, in a, you know, you could be watching it as part of a large event, which, you know, you're talking about the World Cup. We've had, you know, hosting parties, you know, in cities around the country. And I know obviously Liverpool isn't a massive supporter of the, you know, the English national team either, which I'm not, I used to be, but it's been quite some time. I think that being able to detach myself from bias and that fervor there, really, you know, just because like I'm a football fan and a season ticket holder, match going all the time, it doesn't mean I have to always tilt it towards the club that I support. And I feel that being able to take a step back, and this wasn't a noticeable thing, I don't think, personally, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a bias or anything to support and being passionate to support the team, it, no matter who you support, I see why that happens. But I find it easier to deal with disappointment then. Mm. No matter how successful a club is, a team in a, you know, in a generation and a time frame, everybody goes through a period of a lull or of underachievement. It's impossible. Football's cyclical. To, you know, it's impossible to keep that any, you know, level of success going, regardless of money, by the way, regardless of it. City are riding high at the moment, won 5 of the last 6 Premier League.
Man City, this is to our international listeners. Which they're all now like.
Yeah. But never have won a European trophy, major European trophy, right? So if they're the best team in the world, the best club in the world, whatever, then they have limits and ceilings as well. I like to have a feeling of the disenfranchisement and the way that I can go to a game and I can leave all my thoughts in the ground, and I don't, unless I go for a pint afterwards, and then it's really rare that I will be talking about discussing the results for more than like half an hour, honestly, because I think it's just evolution. The older you get, evolution within yourself of regards, as you say, you know, some people say it's just a game. It isn't just a game to some people. And I totally get some people. You know, there was an argument right in front of us where there was a guy who basically, and a lot of people know who he is, by the way, but I won't say who he is because it's unfair to discuss him with him not, you know, being able to. And this isn't like, you know, having a go at him or anything, but he was just trying to, we were 3-0 down against Newcastle at this point, 70 minutes. A lot of people are going, and he's like fuming. And he's saying, why do you bother coming if you're going to leave? You shouldn't be leaving, they need us now. And a lot of people are going, well, you know, and all these things in a heat of the moment, of course. No, I don't. Why should I stay and watch this? You know what I mean? What do they give us? And this guy, you know, the initiator basically had said, it's all I've got. And another guy said, it's all of us have got. We don't deserve this. And I think when you let it seep in, and I'm not saying it's easier now, it's easy for me to say it. It, you know, some people have lost loved ones. They've lost, you know, like they've come out of relationships. You know what I mean? We're talking about real life here. And a lot of people do go to that, you know, temple of some sort of fantasy or dream land where they live in hope of one thing, one constant in their life, that is a football club, win, lose or draw, regardless. Mm. This is why I don't see why, and this is my main point with the, what, you know, this horrible word, banter, of fans fighting with each other, as in, like, you know, over social media or even in pubs or whatever. That has got absolutely out of control now. And it has been for quite some time. How many times do you know Liverpool fans go into, you know, an away ground and they can hear songs being sung about Hillsborough? How is that even? How does that even enter someone's mind? I, you know, people like you and me wouldn't even comprehend things like that. You don't even think about saying it. But when there's a collective, that just shows how far. And this is why football gets such a bad reputation all the time, because of the, or in my opinion as well, the pure lack of humanity. You know, if anyone is going to sit alongside Liverpool, it's going to be Everton in that way, because we all knew somebody who was a Hillsborough. That was nothing to do with football. That's about humans. That's humanity. There's no way that people should be even saying anything about anything. I'm not going to touch that subject, and it's not that I'm like ignoring it, but I know that there are, you know, you mentioned the World Cup, and that was a whole new issue, which for me just demonstrated exactly where we are in the world, not with football, but with everything. Anywhere where there is money, there is corruption. There always has been. And you look at Qatar, and you look at, you know, the way that that legacy that they wanted was put together, and over 5,000, nearly 6,000 people lost their lives with regards to the building of the stadiums. And, you know, you look at Gianni Infantino, who said, you know, who gave that absolutely ludicrous speech, you know, in the like the pre-tournament presser.
I am LGBT, he said. I said, well, that's right. We'll go to Qatar and say that, and let's see what happens when they arrest you in the streets. It's ridiculous what he said.
And the amount of things, but you know, as if he was basically saying football's for everyone. But he didn't say that, though. Why did he say it the way he said it? And I think it's because these people are just completely clouded in their judgments and morals because of the dollar that they accept. And what people have to remember is that, like, for example, Saudi Arabia make a lot of money from oil. Their currency is twinned with the US dollar because they sell that amount. That their main income is oil. So their currency will never, ever, like, be outweighed by the US dollar, because it's sat in, you know, a parallel to it. Or, you know, it's tied. If the US dollar takes a hit, the Saudi, you know, the barrels of oil will be the same price. They will always be the same price. If it's 100 $100 for a barrel of oil, it will always be whatever the same Saudi currency is. And I think that when you've got the US, who's against the Middle East so much, they don't seem to want to have a go at countries where they have a lot of good trade deals with. They obviously clearly don't care about China and things like that. But these politics always will become part of sport while there's that much money involved. It's not a game. It really is not just a game.
I think basically you've touched on the kind of things I wanted to explore. And I said to Paul, just for the listeners here, I know you're very knowledgeable about football and you write a lot about it and you support it. I think what you've done there is you've touched on how football embodies the personal and the political in terms of its identity. It's like a religion. And whether your team's doing well or not doing well, it kind of almost means the same thing. I remember Alan Stubbs, who played for Everton years ago, saying, like, as you become more successful, you almost become more frustrated because you just want to be that bit more successful. And in many ways, there's like a Buddhist kind of philosophy to football where you enjoy everything about it. If you enjoy everything about it, the little things, the senses when you first go to the game. I remember when I first went to the match, the noise, the smell of the pies, the sound of the songs, seeing the green pitch and the way it lit up. It was like beyond real. It was like hyper real. And you've got these people who are running around after a haggis. And yet it's a religious thing. And all these people are singing and wearing all these colours. And you win. And it's like, wow, Graham Sharp scored. And we beat Watford 4-1 when I first went to the game, my first match. And I was too small to see. And it does leave an impression to you, and it is part of your family traditions, and it is like a religion. But as you say, increasingly, I remember my dad saying that when he was young, our fellas would say to him, old men, just a business this now, lad, you know what I mean? And when I grew up, my dad was quite like dispassionate about a lot of it, but he still watches them now and supports them and stuff, like my mum. But the political aspect to it, I remember my uncle complaining about paying £7.70 for us to go and see Wimbledon in the, must have been very early 90s. We drew 1-1 with Wimbledon, scored a late penalty. And in kicking off about £7.70, and you look at the cost of a ticket now, and by the way, Everton's not too bad compared to many.
It's still not.
But the cost of going to football, I mean, if you're an Arsenal fan in London, who's getting paid the average wage, I mean, where do you even start if you're paying thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pounds? And you have people like Graham Souness saying, oh, this is fantastic. Look at all these people going for the dinner at half time and all that, as if that's a great thing. All these people going down for these corporate meals. Makes me sick. And I think what you just said then about how it then widens into the broader geopolitical, not even political spheres, geopolitics, resource depletion, the types of societies we have. And we all know that business often, you know, as long as you get secure, as long as you're okay with your investments coming back, dictatorships, people like that, human rights abusers. Think about Argentina in 78, the military junta there when we had the World Cup there. But that World Cup stickened me, that last World Cup. And me and my dad, we sometimes watch the women's football. We kind of enjoy watching that, you know, to see the differences between the games. Not taking that away from the beauty of the game. That World Cup made me sick. And people might say, oh, yeah, but there's been previous times when this has happened and, you know, the Soviet Union in 1980 and the USA in 1984, you know, not going to each other's Olympics and all that. But I feel like we crossed the bridge with that most recent one, particularly in Fantini's defences, particularly after the light that's been shone on football globally. I mean, Sepp Blatter saying that a report into corruption. Oh, I don't think it would be helpful to release that. This is about 10 years ago. A report into corruption in FIFA. Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA, says, I don't think it would be helpful to release that report now. And we've got all these stories about people being given checks and cash in hand to secure votes for World Cups.
Yeah.
Dickon and Paul, I'll let you come in.
Did you say it was your uncle? £7.70.
Yeah, me and our Tom, my uncle Tom, went to, and there was about four of us, we all went to the game, and he was going, £7.70 to come to the game, you know what I mean? He was complaining about that, and like now it's like £7.70 to buy a drink in the ground, you know what I mean?
But what's the relative inflation comparison with regards to that? Because
well,
it was obviously
around
years.
That time, an euro was 15 pence and euros are now 75, 80 pence. So you're probably saying about a quarter up. So that would be about £28. But if you're buying a one-off ticket, it's a lot more than £28, even at Everton. It'd be closer to 40, I would have thought.
I mean, we've like Tuesday just gone, me and Tom, we've just paid our, we've got the season ticket on the monthly instalment, and that's our third monthly instalment for next season already that we pay. Not all clubs are able to offer that as well. So I do, you know, I do appreciate the fact that that's, you know, structure, the payment structure is available. But with regards to geopolitical and this is, you know, you go back to many different things now, and it's not just football, is it? Let's go back. I mean, what about the Munich Olympics in 72? Was it 72? I think it was.
Yeah, it was 72, yeah.
And, you know, you look at the atrocities there, and boundaries are just broken all the time. So something else happens. It's not like it's swept under the carpet, but it's played down. There's a smoke screen. There's always something else now. In a news, in an era of 24-hour rolling news, there aren't that many important stories that stay in the, you know, in the headlines, regardless of whether it's China going to South Sudan and just basically taking all the oil and pillaging villages and everything. And you know what I mean? Things that you don't see. But, you know, now, as long as it's like put in your face, oh yeah, this is a fantastic World Cup. Look at the World Cup final. Probably the best game of football I've watched for a long time.
Yeah, I was good, yeah.
But it made me ill that it came, because that World Cup is now always going to remember for unbelievable football and 12 minutes of injury time in the first part of the tournament. But, you know, it's just, it's a thing where they've got a product there which is absolutely unbelievable. And they're making, it's just like the Premier League, they're now going to take away, which I don't believe is good or bad or whatever, but how far behind the American model are they, that the Premier League are going to take or are going to host their own football channel? So Sky, you know, Amazon, BT, whoever they are, DAZN were coming in as well. DAZN were actually coming in about the EFL deal that's, you know, just been announced yesterday, Friday.
So they're all companies that show football or want to show football, and the EFL are the leagues below the Premier League in England, aren't they?
Yeah, so you've got England is usually, you know, is has the most amount of professional leagues. And I know you would think that inventing the game and stuff and whatever, but it's still incredibly watchable. The support, local grassroots, they've seen figures shoot up because of the really ill feeling between, you've had splinter football clubs set up with the likes of, you know, City of Liverpool, AFC Liverpool and stuff, and, you know, FC United and Manchester and stuff like that. The thing is now is that, yes, you do need money to survive, but you look now at clubs like Brighton, Brentford, you know, Leicester won the league. None of these clubs, yes, they have money. They have more money than the Championship. They have more money than Salford City. They have more money, you know, than you know, the likes of Bury, who went out of existence, but I think they're, you know, on their way back now, aren't they? Which is really good, you know, to see as well, which is interesting because the Neville's mum and dad were very involved at Bury because that's where they're from. So it's interesting, you know, that it makes me wonder why Salford City was taken over. And this isn't having a go. I'm just wondering why that has happened. Why, I wonder why they didn't take Bury over, or I don't know what the intricacies are involved. You know, you've got Robbie Savage, who's, you know, ex-Leicester, Birmingham. I think he was in that class of 92. But
yeah, he was at United originally, wasn't he, Robbie Savage? Yeah. Man United.
He's now involved with Macclesfield Town. I saw him saying on BT Sport the other day that they're going for a third promotion on the run next year. Obviously, they've sunk right down and they were in, you know, the Football League for quite a number of years. You've got a lot of teams in the Northwest actually seem to undergo more financial hardship and have been go into administration than others, it seems to me. I don't know if that's me just, you know, off the top of my head.
It could be socioeconomics as well, because a lot of traditional football teams came from the north. And then if you haven't got the financial underpinnings, it can be hard. But just going back to that, I mean, there was another Liverpool team created with the idea of allowing local people the ability to afford to go and watch a team from Liverpool. And there was some kickback from LFC over that.
Of course, yeah.
FC United were created out when the Glazers took over because people rejected that kind of like model of putting the club heavily into debt, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But one of the things that like has been spreading around in recent years, now we can talk about the German model where the tickets are far more affordable and they have like social projects in the local communities. Now we know, like for example, Everton have got a good Everton in the Community initiative to do things with vulnerable people and etc., etc. That does happen in the Premier League. Sorry, I sound like the American there, the Premier League. But you've got the German model, which is far more inclusive. Normal people can afford it. People can drink and smoke in the stands, I believe. But a few years ago, something that emerged was these ideas of supporter trusts, which are linked to national organisation and recognition, exist at a football club to represent fans' interest against this idea of this like elite who now run clubs, sometimes international elites who live abroad, etc. I was actually part of setting up Everton Supporters Trust, and we really struggled to get going because of the idea that Everton were in crisis, Moshiri had just taken over, etc. And Everton were a threat of relegation and anything like that at the time. Obviously, things have changed, but that Supporters Trust model, it tried to get off the ground in the Premier League about 8 years ago. And it's kind of gone off the agenda because of this constant taking over by, if you like, international financial interests, etc., at Man City, at Newcastle, Liverpool, Everton, basically in the Premier League, now you need to be owned by someone with a lot of money, often abroad. Is that the only show in town to be successful in football? I mean, we talked there about Leicester, Brentford, and stuff. Obviously, they might have owners who are based abroad who are very, very powerful. But is that the only show in town? And does that just mirror the fact that that's what society is increasingly becoming like, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I don't think it is. I'm not a financial expert, of course. I'm not an expert on anything. Way that I see it. But you have to be able to use the literature that you've got and read between the lines. You shouldn't always accept things for what they are. You know, you should do, and I'm definitely not, going into conspiracy theory. Don't just accept things, like we had. Well, you look at what was the biggest thing that people didn't know too much about, where lies were told, and that's turned out to be absolutely horrific. In this country, we don't even have to say the word, do we? And also, I don't want to say
just the say word. The word in case someone's listening in Australia or New Zealand.
Yeah, no, but I don't. The only reason I don't want to say it is because it's a compound, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the person who came up with that word, the compound word, I don't like him either. So the word I'm talking about, obviously, is Brexit. It's not a word. Britain's exit from Europe. Basically, it was just used as a buzzword that stuck by Boris Johnson. And the worst thing is that he didn't even vote for Brexit. He didn't even want it. But he wanted to be front and center of politics in Britain, despite having absolutely no morals, no intelligence with regards. He's a very intelligent man. In certain ways, but he was put in because of his charisma, buffoonery and stuff that people had seen before. A total mess he made being a mayor of London. And then when there's an agenda that's on the list, as we know, look at the, hashtag stop the boats now from the Conservative Party. If people are told, if I'm doing something right and I say to you, don't look at what I'm doing, look at what your neighbour's doing. That's where the problem is. Yeah. And if you're telling someone in football now, look what Man City have done. So Newcastle are going to have to go out and get and be a state-owned a country. I know it isn't, but it pretty much is. They've got £365 billion to spend. Now, FFP is just a joke. It's going to be taken away.
So that's called financial fair play, isn't it? That was an idea introduced that to stop huge amounts of money being spent by rich owners, clubs had to have a level of sustainability that they only spend what they generate. So what do you think about that? Just finish that point.
Well, you look at Everton. Everton have not spent only what they've generated at all, have they? And how, you know, people say, oh, the cost of ticket prices for wages. The cost of ticket prices in the season tickets doesn't go anywhere near. Arsenal, they generated the most amount of capital on a match day with regards to income. About £2 million the first, every match day. This was the very first that they started. I think it was Deloitte and Touche, was it, who came up with the first, you know, details of oh, you know, the Emirates, fantastic stadium. And there's the value behind it because it's generating, you know, this income now. So yes, building a new stadium, which people thought it's a soulless bowl, and you know, getting away from traditional football stadiums, which obviously Goodison still is, to stay in, even in touch on the coattails of teams that have got, you know, the global support. But what does global support actually mean? If you're talking about ticket prices and people being able to go to a game, it doesn't matter how far away someone comes. You can only get it. You know, there's a finite amount of bodies that can go into a ground, isn't it?
Mm.
So that means that you've got a limited supply there. So that's why, obviously, owners of football clubs are now, or any sports team, by the way, but, you know, primarily football, it, you know, is the big earner. And you would say that, you know, that we can only get, this is our ceiling of income on a match day. So now what we need to do, like in Spain, by the way, where Barcelona and Real Madrid have got the lion's share of the TV money because they feel that's right, because they're the most successful. Well, hang on, that's an enabler, isn't it? How do you want a competitive league or not? There was an unnamed Premier League executive about, I don't know, even though, I can't remember how long ago it was now, but I think it was just before lockdown. So I think it was about 2019. And he was quoted, and this was unnamed. I don't know if this person has, you know, has had a name reveal or not. With regards Leicester, and saying we know that most fans want to see the big clubs winning trophies. We don't want another Leicester. Now, I don't know if that was taken out of context, which sometimes, you know, things are. But as a takeout quote, doesn't that sum up the whole Premier League era? You know, how many times now do you have on Sky? Oh, you know, this is like the best run since like the Premier League began. Football didn't begin in 1992. You know what I mean? Yeah. Everton were like established in 1878. And obviously our rivals Liverpool after the split, which again, people can go in and do their own research on that, in 1892, when Everton were kicked out of, you know, Anfield, you know, Liverpool's ground, because they wouldn't pay the rise in rent, in ground rent. So you're going back 140 years, basically. 135 years. We're on now, aren't we? It's absolutely... No, actually, it's 155 years, isn't it? Yeah, 145 years. Sorry, yeah. Bad maths. You look at the short period of time since there's been an unbelievable influx of money and all the years gone by before that for history. Mm. You know, who's the last, like, second division team to win a trophy, you know, an FA Cup? Are we still going back to, was it West Ham in 80? 76, Southampton, I think, were a second division team as well. Mm. You know, there was, you know, you look at, like, when Derby County came up and then won the league. That goes against what the Premier League is saying. Oh, you know, the six breakaway clubs who wanted the English clubs who wanted to go into the
European Super League.
Yeah, and they were saying, well, no, we don't want that. Obviously, because they're going to lose an incredible amount of their income. So now it seems that they're just going, well, like, we need to give them everything that they want, or they'll kick up a fuss again.
And by the way, it was disgraceful that those clubs paid, they were fined £3.5 million for that. It was also interesting how a lot of the fans of those clubs like kind of said, oh, yeah, we're disgusted, but, oh, you can't blame the fans for what our clubs have tried to do. This is why loads of other clubs are going to the war, like, because they've declare bankruptcy. But if you go back to the G17 group, which dissolved a few years ago, they were like a pressure group of elite clubs that basically wanted to generate as much money as possible.
Beautiful
and
trip.
Then you had the six Super League clubs who literally wanted to say, now we want to generate huge amounts of money from TV, because TV is where most of the money is. And again, none of this is really discussed. You know, if you look at like the media and the news, etc., they don't really discuss these issues. And there's a lot of like, I've spoken to fans before of like big clubs, and you go, what do you think of this then? Or, oh, that's what you've got to do now to compete. And everyone's obsessed with what the other team are doing. And to a degree, like Everton fans, like, you know, create our own narrative. And, you know, you think about when the European band kicked in the 80s, Everton had probably their best team just at that time, and it never really had a chance to push on. And you can talk about, like, you know, Luis Suarez, who played for Liverpool, his behaviour in the derbies, his diving, etc. I heard like Everton got a bit of a dodgy penalty at Anfield a few years ago, and a Liverpool fan went, that's karma, that, because when Liverpool got one a year later, and I remember thinking, like, we're still waiting for karma from the European band, you know what I mean? But I don't really want to go down the Everton, poor Everton agenda today. But obviously, you'd always see things your own way, and people are loyal to the clubs, etc. But that European Super League, they basically got off with that effectively scot-free. And when the Premier League was introduced, they said, oh, it'll all filter down into the lower leagues and the grassroots. The same thing, you, like Liz Truss believed that, like, oh, yeah, let's have a growth agenda, it'll all filter down. And that's where politics and sport basically become one, because these ridiculous ideologies and beliefs in elites, the old British system of super universities, let's get our super elites and we'll run the world and we'll like show people what to do, and the myth of meritocracy nonsense. And who do we get? Boris Johnson, privately educated buffoon. And that's ultimately, you know, it's ridiculous. And football is part of the bread and circuses narrative. And I know that, and you know that. And, you know, you put me in a room with a Liverpool fan or a United fan, and then a bit of debate starts, and then you start getting in your trenches. But the whole thing for me is a joke.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I'm disgusted with it. And I go to the game, and, I like going to the game. I think, you know, how much are these players getting paid? I mean, I used to like some of the players because I felt like people like Joe Parkinson. And my dad will say, he was still getting a few grand a week. He said, players used to get the bus to the game with us. We'd be on the bus, and one of the players would be on the bus going to the football game. The whole thing for me now, it's not based on the idea of equality. It's based on this idea of super elitism. And they have literally got you round the little finger, because it does matter so much to people. And that's why they can afford to charge you such high ticket prices, etc. Because they know ultimately that's what you believe in, and that's what it's all about. But for me, I am disgusted with it all. And it's just a game. And yeah, I want Everton to win and do well. But the way football is run in this country, particularly football, it makes me stomach turn.
It doesn't sound like it, but I am an enabler, because I'm getting a season ticket, but, you know, and I'm giving the money towards it. But my point is that in this era now, and this generation, you've got to choose your vices now, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So why would I want to go? I want to be there while I can see what's happening right in front of me. Mm. I don't want to go to a pub and spend that money.
Mm.
Because most of the time, and don't get me wrong, I will go to independent pubs. I very, very rarely now go to chain pubs, because I know that independents need the money.
Mm.
But I won't go there to watch a match. I'll stay in the house. Because they're going to get money, you know, from other... I'll go to times when there are lulls, usually, when they're not getting... Oh, no, I'm not like I'm saving pubs. I don't mean it like that. But, you know, my point is that I want to be there. Well, you know, not to... And I'm not going to say it, but don't... I'm going to say a phrase now, but don't link it to me. You'll know what I mean now. I don't want to be a Doubting Thomas. I want to be there, and I want to, you know, witness what's going on for myself. The amount of times you'll see people, or you'll have a conversation with people, that was awful, that, wasn't it? Where did you see that on the TV? It doesn't matter how many replays you get. You can see what goes on in other, you know, parts of the pitch. It's not, from time to time, I'll watch one player for 20 minutes just to see how he plays in that position, see how he's coping, what is, you know, his body language is like and things like that. And I think, you absolutely 100% do not get that on television. They used to have a player cam thing, didn't they, if you remember, on Sky Sports, where you could actually, I don't know, it wasn't massively successful. Obviously, they're thinking, well, we're paying money, you know, for the production of that and whatever, and it, enough people tuning into it, there's no point, let's get rid of it. I think that's an unbelievable thing. And the reason I say it is because most of the, you know, you look at talk sports, I absolutely detest it. Basically just devil's advocate radio. And we know why, because people who were connected with the Sun newspaper, which is absolute filth, as we know, set that up with talk radio. Talk sports, oh, hang on, you're just talking about politics. Are you messing? You're not telling me now that, and this is how they feel about working class people, as we know. All we're going to do is get a rise out of them, right? We'll say something that they don't agree with. We'll put a premium rate telephone number on there and they'll call up. They won't think about that because they're too angry. They won't think about how much it's costing them because they think, well, I'll only do it once. And then people are sucked in. And all the time, they'll have one person saying one thing, Dean Saunders, who can't even spell his own name. And you've got a guy in the opposite corner who will say something, totally disagreeing, whether they agree with it, whether they agree with what they're saying, you know what I mean? Whether that's their actual factual, you know, thought. It, all it is to get a rise out of people.
Absolutely.
What dictates social media?
Absolutely. I mean, we can get into social media. I know we can talk about Twitter and the ridiculous discussions on Twitter, but I did a podcast with a guy called Paul Cope, and he's a big Liverpool fan. He goes on like podcasts and stuff, and he says now he watches a game quite calmly, and if they get beat, he does, because he thinks it's a mark of self-esteem. He said, if you've got low self-esteem, you get more upset by it. And I thought, he's right. And sometimes, Paul, I actually listen to the podcasts and the analysis after the game and talk to people about it rather than watch the game, because I'm not happy with the way I become during the game. I haven't been in the game for a while. I haven't been this season at all, actually. And sometimes I watch it, sometimes I won't watch it, but I'll just listen to watch the highlights and listen to the analysis. And it's sad that, like, I feel like I have to do that because I take it that seriously. But you're right, they're trying to wind you up. And, you know, if you think about, like, the sports washing, you know, the famous phrase sports washing, where people take over a club to look better. So certain regimes around the world with dodgy records buy successful clubs, put loads of money into it and say, oh, look, we're investing in your countries. We're reputable businesses. Do you know what I mean? You've got all this going on in the background. And then, as you say, that talk sport, I can't even listen to it because I find the level of discussion absolutely pathetic. And I'm not interested in it. And that's why that raw emotion is exploited. The Times said, before all the commercialisation, that football was a slum game watched by slum people in slum stadiums. And all of a sudden, part of the Premier League thing, oh yeah, we can make some money out of this. And look where we are today. Shocking, yeah. Mate, shocking.
With regards to, you look at, what, like the late 1800s, with regards to a very similar report like that, an article that was written about cities, you know, with regard, I know Liverpool was one of them. Basically, I think it was again the Times newspaper, I'm sure it was. And basically, you know, saying that, you know, working class city is just awash with, you know, poverty, slum areas and things like that. And as if then you understand what happened between 79 and 92 when a certain Prime Minister was in charge. Again, someone who I just can't, you know, bring myself to whose name to say. And Liverpool was a big target for that because of the, you know, the rebellion against that. Because this city will always stand up for what, you know, what it believes in.
Yeah. I think Liverpool exceptionalism goes into the political, the economic sphere, the accents. And I think you said before, like a lot of people in Liverpool are not really supporters of the English national side because of the tradition of like Liverpool being exceptional, different, the 80s with the militants, etc. But that also impacted on the whole Hillsborough analysis where our Liverpool fans misbehaving. The media, the police, the government all sing from the same hymn sheet, condemn people and blame people. You know what I mean?
But also, Tim, that was almost like resultant of the actual hooliganism that had been taking place in the 80s. So that Hillsborough was part of the, you know, tarred with that hooliganism brush, where the outside of people who weren't there, football wasn't hardly televised then. Yes, it was an FA Cup semi-final. And yes, it was on grandstand, because I remember being there as a kid. I mean, obviously, I'm 2.5, 3 years younger than you, aren't I? And I was looking at it as a 9-year-old boy thinking, I don't know what's going on. All I could see were people on the pitch. And we're talking probably about 3:10. And I was only in my nan's, which is actually, you know, only around the corner from your folks, isn't it? And so I would imagine, like, to, you know, my dad and my uncles and stuff like that would have been in the pub, which is equidistant between there, which is well gone now, the Walnuts. They would have been in there at that point. So I don't know what their thoughts were. Or,
well, you know, I was watching that with my dad, and my mate was at the Liverpool game, and he came home from Hillsborough. You'll know us now. I won't mention him like on here, but I went over to play football over the road, and then I saw him coming back with his dad in the van, and he waved at me, and I thought, well, at least I know he's okay. But as soon as there was issues in the crowd, you had police officers walking past, apparently, and people were saying, listen, we're getting crusty, and the police officers just looked at them and looked away, because they were the hooligans, this agenda of the hooligans. And you also had this idea on the telly, you're going, oh, look at this terrible hooliganism. No one actually said, ooh, something's going on here. It immediately fitted into the narrative of hooliganism. You know what I mean?
Well, the first person actually who was John Motson on commentary that day, and he knew that something wasn't right.
Yeah, sorry, you're right. It was when it went back to the studio that narrative of hooliganism came in, which was completely unfit into the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing, you see, where Liverpool always gets a bad rep. And obviously, look at how long it took for the Justice for Hillsborough campaign to actually make a dent, because everybody was just, you know, I remember working somewhere, right, and probably about 2004 or 2005, right, and I remember there was a woman who was from down south. I can't remember exactly where she was from, but she mentioned the Sun newspaper, and I was like, what, why would you even talk about that? And she started laughing, going, why would it, like, what's wrong with the newspaper? It just showed that it made us as a city look insular, as if we were like, oh, yes, that's why people sing Always the Victims. Nothing to do with Hillsborough, by the way, with regards, you know, that in that way, because people, people do sing it because of that as well. But there are other people who think we're always just moaning all the time. You look at what
Boris Johnson said, it didn't he?
Yeah, exactly, in his editorial. And that is exactly the point, where you're battling against these things all the time. And this is very relevant to this, you know, to this discussion. With regard, that's just an example, another example of how people don't listen to people. And then it turns out to be true. Yeah. Why weren't you listening to us? We know why you weren't listening to us, because you were sweeping it under the carpet. So don't think that we're not going to keep on doing this all the time, as if we're going to go, we've got one bit of justice, that's fine, we're happy now. No, we will keep on fighting things all the time. And other people in other areas, you know, look at
Grenfell disaster. That's like the new Hillsborough. And it has been completely brushed under the carpet. Just to start tying things
together, is what I'm saying.
But that's it, yeah. Just to start finishing off, Paul, I know it's like the King's coronation today, and we want to go and get dressed up and put our crowns on, etc., and, you know, celebrate the monarchy. But there are some good things about football, like the women's team's done well recently, fan resistance to the Super League, you know, Black Lives Matter becoming part of the footy, and what Rashford's done recently. There's a lot of good stuff about football as well, and, you know, we're having a bit of a critique of it today. But Everton, let's finish with Everton, who are looking like going down. There's a lot of discontent with Everton at the moment.
I can hear people cheering in the background. When
yeah, good on them. And in many ways, it is funny. And in many ways, it's what Everton deserve. It's not what the fans deserve. Yeah. But we have got a leader at the top who's made a lot of interventions and been very hands-on. And the perception is that he's interfered. Some people even say with team selection at times. We've had people getting sacked, fired, people knowing directors of football who apparently should be making the decisions when a manager, and then the chairman's getting involved. We've got a board. There's no longer AGMs at the club. We've got a board who are currently not even coming to the game. Who,
it's the second.
Basically, if I was on Everton's board, if you're not Pro Machiri, you're not on the board. So there's a lot of criticism at Everton at the minute. And I always felt when we set up the trust, we need the fans to have a voice. There's people doing protests. Then when the game starts, it's like, right, let's get behind the team. The protests are separate.
Yep.
Everton, if you like, it becomes symptomatic of this kind of detachment between who runs the clubs and the fans. How would you sum up the situation at Everton? How can Evertonians like me and you, what can we do to survive this terrible time? I think we're going to go down. I think we probably deserve to go down.
I've been at peace with it since the half-time in the Palace game last season. And honestly, my passion, I'm not even joking, right? I was sitting at home. I had the Leicester game on. And I had the Snooker World Championship on my laptop. And I've not been that dispassioned with a game. They play really well. But my passion, I don't get angry with it anymore. Mm. Last year, when we got beat 3-2 by Burnley, and that's, I don't usually say we, by the way, because it's not we. I don't feel like it's a belonging thing, you know, and especially I didn't do any. So the fans are getting blamed for the way the club is now. Don't know how. That's, you know, the statement that comes from the chairman and Machiri and all. And this is just a very, very, very small piece of Everton's history. If this investment that's supposed to be coming in does materialise and the stadium does actually get built, because I still don't believe that it's going to be finished. It's going to be the biggest white elephant on the waterfront and embarrassing. But I was even speaking to one of my brothers yesterday, and he was saying it could be the, you know, best thing for Everton to go down. And I was like, but they may not survive. It could take 10 years. They could actually go out of existence. They really could. I don't think they understand the enormity of this situation, but it could be a very small part of Everton's history if this investment comes in and they can work things out. But the other thing I say is, and I totally understand this as well, I mentioned Berry before, didn't I? Berry would be going, oh, boo-hoo, Everton are going to get relegated from the Premier League. You've been there for, you know, forever, and certainly in the top flight football since 1954. But you also look at those things where, you know, each individual, like, support has to stick up for its own. And I get that. I don't want to see Macclesfield having to go all the way back down, Stockport being able to come back up after getting relegated, Hartlepool are going down. You know, look at Tranmere winning the Championship, about 2012, 2000.
They were pushing on the door of the Premier League for years, weren't they?
Yeah, well, in the 90s they were, yeah. And I used
yeah,
to
in
go,
the 90s, yeah.
And then you look at that, you know, they got to two League Cup finals as well. 2000, is it 97 and 2001, I think, or 2000, got beat by Leicester. And then you look at those other, you know, the other clubs who are thinking, and I'm not saying it's jealousy, but it's not. I admire people who support clubs that, you know, you always think of Grandad in Only Fools and Horses. Oh, you don't used to say that one day Millwall would win the cup. And I remember before, they got to the FA Cup final. Dale actually scored the winner at Old Trafford against Sunderland. And then they got 3-0 by Manchester United, which was obvious. It was Cristiano Ronaldo at that point. But that just, you know, you always think Everton are actually fortunate enough to still be the fourth most successful team in England. And a lot of people, you know, forget this because the things that have been won in the past, they're not forgotten, you know. Just be it only convenient to bring them up because United have won 20. When Alex Ferguson took over Manchester United, right, in 1986, Everton had more top flight league titles than United. They were on 7 at that time. They're now on 20. Everton are still on 9. They still haven't won any, you know, they basically won one trophy in that time as well, the FA Cup. But, you know, 98% of season ticket holders have chosen to renew their season tickets at Everton. And we still don't know what division that Everton are going to be in. I'm one of those who's renewed season ticket. And, you know, my son, the guy who sits next to me as well, and all around, for the club to accuse the fans of blame and for being in this situation. Hang on, we're the loyal ones. They haven't even turned up to a game since the 2nd of January. You had people on the 14th of January who came in with regards to MSP investments, who were, that was, we got beat 2-1 by Southampton that day. And I was thinking, wow, why would they still want to be involved? This is basically the death knell of the club as we know it at the moment. But I'm hoping that that doesn't materialise. I've swayed back to thinking we definitely need those results. Everton need to stay in the Premier League. And all right, people thinking, no, you know, things might not change. The board are untenable now. Whether Everton get relegated or not, they cannot be here after the summer. So that investment needs to come in. Although Moshiri's saying the club isn't for sale, he's saying that the money is just to, you know, basically he's going to be there till the ground gets built, and then he'll sell that, either the rights of the ground or the club as a whole at that point. But yeah. I'll park my voice for now, and thank you very much for inviting me on, and sorry for deafening everyone. But all I say is, my only thing is, you know, to take away from this, don't let the bastards grind you down.
Do you know what? Just to finish, I remember we were playing cards, me and my mates, in 2016, and my mate Kev said, I wouldn't put it past Everton to mess this up when the investment came in from Moshiri. And my uncle, who went to the first get Everton game, had said, I always remember him saying that. And we've literally messed it up. And
they have.
But literally Everton have got a guy in charge who is arbitrary, who's random. There's no real clear hierarchy because of the amorphous structurelessness of the system there. He just gets involved in everything. That's my perception of it. You've got a board who are basically just like smiling faces.
You need to look at Porter's five forces, Tim.
The what?
You need to look at Porter's five forces. He doesn't even know that structure of a business.
It's chaos. And then we've got this big stadium getting built. I feel if we go down, we could fall through the floor financially. And as you say, it could be existential. Look at Burnley. They've gone down. They've come back up. They've always been conservative, Burnley, in terms of, like, they're not going to go spending loads of money, et cetera, et cetera. We've literally mortgaged everything. And if we go down, we could be in trouble. And Paul, I know that you need to go now, and we'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Hope Everton stay up. I'm sure they won't. And football, people, we need to rise together and take over the footballing world. Paul, thank you very much, mate.